Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member, FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan, Chase & Co. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I am joined by reporter and podcaster Matt Bellany. He's the author of Puck's flagship newsletter, What I'm Hearing, where he covers the real inside conversation about money and power in Hollywood. He also does this on his excellent podcast, The Town, which comes from Puck and The Ringer. Bellany was formerly an entertainment attorney before pivoting to journalism, first writing at Esquire, then The Hollywood Reporter, where he eventually became the editorial director. But since he left The Reporter back in 2020, he's become something of a trusted Hollywood insider, especially throughout this dual labor strike over the summer between the writers, actors, and the studios, where a deal has yet to be made between the respective guilds and the AMPTP, which includes Amazon, Apple, Netflix, NBC Universal, Warner Bros. Discovery, Disney, Paramount, and Sony. And so as we move into fall, without a clear deal in sight, I wanted to have Matt on to offer his clear-headed, no-bullshit perspective on the state of play, which includes the negotiations themselves, the demands from guilds that have yet to be met by the studios, and why I think this all matters outside of Hollywood. Because a lot of the press I've read during these strikes seems to be tailored to people within the entertainment industry. In fact, in conversations I've had with people, you know, throughout this summer, people who don't work in film and television, the question I often get is, why should I care about this? Why does this matter to me? Especially as we've seen a surge in strikes and union organizing across the country. Why should we focus on this specific battle in Hollywood? And so if those questions sound a little familiar to you, or if those are questions you've received, you know, from family members that don't understand what's going on, then I think this conversation with Matt will be of use to you. Because beyond the current crisis in Hollywood, we spend a lot of time talking about how we got to this breaking point, and really what these strikes mean, not just for the future of film and television, but for the consumer, for you, for anyone that subscribes to these various streaming platforms, for anyone confused about what the hell is going on in Hollywood, for anyone that just wants this art form to continue, I think this back and forth will be interesting to you and a sobering assessment of where we've been, where we're at, and where we may be headed in the years to come. That's all up next with our guest, Matt Ballady. Stay with us.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Matt Ballady, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
How does it feel to be on someone else's podcast?
You know, I do it a lot, actually, because I started with a weekly slot on The Business, the KCRW show with Kim Masters. So I'm used to being the guest. I will say it's very different being the host of a show than being the guest. It's so much harder to be the one that's instigating and leading and determining the show rather than just answering the question. So I'm actually relieved today.
I'm happy to provide some relief and to just guide us through this conversation. It's a good week to be talking because a lot has happened. A lot is happening and a lot will happen next week in particular. You went to the Toronto International Film Festival. Let's just start here. Traditionally, September and fall is really the start of the Oscar season. People are excited, they're gathering, they're talking about these new movies that they hope audiences will find. Obviously, all the PR campaigns are starting for certain actors, directors, etc. At Toronto, what has the spirit been like? Are people as upbeat as usual, or has the strike pretty much dominated these spaces?
I'm sort of developing a hot take on the subject that for the movies and for the festival, I mean, the buzz is just totally muted. For me personally, it was actually kind of better. The parties were more fun. You know, people were more accessible. Their hair was down a little bit more because they didn't have to be around these stars and the client. There was no gawking. But the mood there was, for the business, it was actually kind of nice to kind of be in a relaxed setting. Mm-hmm. But for these festivals and for the movies themselves, it's a disaster. You cannot promote movies properly without stars.
And on the studio side, Do they agree it's a disaster?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've seen several movies get pushed to next year already because they determined that they just weren't going to get a viable release without the promotion that they need. Now, some movies, I think, are a little bit more strike-proof in that regard. If you have a big horror movie that, you know, the premise is the star or the scares are the star, like Exorcist or something like that, then you don't kind of need those stars. But something like Challengers, which was a adult dramedy that was anchored by Zendaya.
Mm-hmm.
When Zendaya is not there to go to the Venice Film Festival and be photographed a million times, like, it's hard to release that movie. Same with Dune. Dune was pushed to next year, the Dune sequel, because if you look at that cast, it's Zendaya, it's Timothée Chalamet, it's Austin Butler, it's all these young, hot stars that you're hoping will bring a younger demo to a 50-year-old franchise. And without that, they pushed it to next year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the impact of the strike on certain movies has been pretty significant from a promotion standpoint.
So the hot take is better for Bellamy,
right?
Worse for studios and all the people that attend the festival.
Yeah, and ultimately the box office. I mean, there's a movie that premiered at TIFF, Dumb Money, which is the GameStop movie, which I enjoy.
It's coming out this weekend.
It's coming out this weekend, yeah. They're doing a platform release. That's a movie that gets greenlit because they have about five or six promotable stars in it. They have Seth Rogen, they have Pete Davidson, they have America Ferrera, they have a number of Paul Dano. And the fact that you couldn't get them up on the stage at Toronto and have them in the press line and the step and repeat, that is it's just devastating for a film like that.
But at these parties, because I've been to TIFF, a couple drinks in, are people with their hair let down, like you said, are they saying to you, good Lord, is this going to end anytime soon?
Oh, they don't even need the drinks. I mean, that you should look at my text messages. Like, dude, what the hell? Like, when? And, you know, everybody has an agenda, and I try to be an arbiter here, and I have my own personal opinions on the strike we can get to. But the level of frustration and anger and just, you know, overwhelming malaise has really ratcheted up since Labor Day. When people came back from the holidays in the summer and it was like, oh, okay, you know, my vacation's over, my kids are back from camp, you know, the school started, my routine is there. And normally I go to work and there's no work and there's no end in sight. And at that point, a couple weeks ago, people weren't talking. And it's like, oh my God, what are we doing here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fall is when people come back from wherever they were and the real, you know, work gets done and films ratchet up again. It's just not happening.
Well, now that we're back here in the city, I'm sure you've seen the recent reports from Drew Barrymore and Bill Maher, both of whom have announced that they will be returning to their respective talk shows this fall without writers from the WGA, who have, of course, been on strike since early May. Barrymore has decided to move forward with a new season of her CBS show with, quote, astute humility. Maher has said,
Maher has no humility.
That was the first quote, followed by a second quote. The writers have important issues that I sympathize with and hope that they are addressed to their satisfaction, but they are not the only people with issues, problems, and concerns. And so both programs will be returning without a deal being reached with the WGA. Where are you at on these decisions? Do you think they portend other shows to come and other decisions this fall as people want to go back to work, try to go back to work?
I think in the daytime segment, the daytime day part, that is certainly the case. Most, if not all, of these shows are coming back. Now, some of them are not WGA at all. Some of them do have segments like Drew Barrymore and a couple of the others have, you know, their sort of hybrid shows and they've made the choice to come back. I think a little bit of that is the competitive nature. You know, it's tough to sit out when your competitors are not sitting out.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I think, is this, when you are the star of one of these shows, you likely have 100 to 200 people that work on your show, almost all of whom are not in the WGA. Crew, craft services, wardrobe, all the people, bookers, everyone whose livelihood is dependent on that show. So when those people are in your ear saying, I need to make rent, I need to buy food, I think that that can be compelling to these hosts. Now, I don't want to say I endorse that because I obviously there's a lot of pain going around in this strike. There's a lot of people who would love to be able to say to their boss, hey, why don't we go back? And if you're on a scripted TV show, that's not an option.
But for those two, are you sympathetic to them?
I mean, I'm sympathetic to people who need a job and need to work. I do think that especially in the case of Bill Maher, it hurts the guild position.
Why is that?
Because there is something about that late night segment. It is so associated with good writing. And Bill would tell you himself, that show is nothing without his writers. And if you look back at the 2007-2008 strike, Conan, Dave, Jay Leno, these guys all came back. They came back after 6 weeks. And if you go back and look at the statements and what they did when they came back, the shows sucked. You know, Conan was like playing with his wedding ring on his table. You can watch the YouTube clips. And they did it. If you look at their statements at the time, they did it because they said, my people are hurting and I am coming back for my people. Mm-hmm. I'm not using writers. And Leno was actually hauled in front of a WGA tribunal because they accused him of using writers and writing. And he was ultimately vindicated on that front.
Is that why he keeps bringing donuts to the picket line?
I think he's just a nice guy. But maybe, yeah, I don't know. I think this strike is different in a number of reasons. The social media element has really changed the equation where the loudest voices in the guild are very powerful and no one wants to get shamed or canceled or attacked or whatever it is. So there's a heightened sense of fear, I think, amongst people that they don't want to piss off the guild in any ways. And I also think that the fact that there are two strikes going on mm-hmm. at the same time and the issues in this one seem to be more existential and the level of direness has been ratcheted up. So when Bill Maher goes back, I think it is a middle finger to the Writers Guild. And they certainly perceive it that mm-hmm. way. Now, it's not entirely surprising. This is a guy whose brand is sort of giving middle fingers to people. And the hallmark of that show is the panel discussion and the interviews. And there are unwritten elements of that show that I think he can do. And it won't be the same show. He's not going to do his new rules segment or his monologue or any of that stuff. But he can do it. And he's made the calculation that for him and for his people, he wants to go back. I also think he probably misses being out of the limelight. I mean, these guys want, and there's a reason why Bill Maher has done this show for as long as he has and works constantly. They want the attention. They want to be in the zeitgeist. They probably see the news going on and saying, man, if I had a show this week.
It should be noted that Bill has continued to do his comedy shows throughout the strike across the country. And he's also had his podcast, which has continued through
That's
this
true.
Entire time. So he's not had complete shortage of work and well-paying work, I should add.
That's true. And a lot of these comics have done that. If you look, you know, the SNL cast, they're all
absolutely.
Touring around.
Yeah.
Seth Meyers is doing a tour. You know, they've all found things to do. They have their podcasts.
As
and
is their right.
Things.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about that television perch that is powerful and he wants to go back, a combination. And listen, it's all a personal decision. It's funny, John Oliver is on the same network and John Oliver, I don't think will go back because that is not his brand. John Oliver is a much more progressive, much more union-friendly brand. And the same with the other late night hosts. I don't see a repeat of 2007-2008.
And I think that's the point. Everyone wants to go back.
Right.
People want to go back to work. And they want a fair and equitable deal. And I think the concern is that circumventing the guild and going back to work, even at a reduced length without writers, without the opening monologue, does put a dent in these negotiations. It does weaken or lessen their leverage.
But that was true 15 years ago. So the question is, what's different now? I think there's a heightened sense of what's going on in this business. Mm-hmm. And there's a fear that if we don't stand up now, we will never be able to get a grip on the economics of the business that are changing. There is the social media element where the consequences of going back now are not just you get some calls from the union and they're mad at you. You know, look at what's going on with Drew Barrymore. I mean, there are memes. She's, you know, she's become a target. And, you know, she probably knew this would happen going into it. And she made the decision anyway. She says, I own it. But that's the consequence now. And that's, I think, a big part of the calculus.
Well, this will be a test of her, quote, astute humility. We're going to find out.
and whether she can book guests when the strike is over.
Yes.
I mean, that's the calculation you have to make, because people don't forget. Maybe they will a little bit, but these talk shows depend on smiling actors coming on the show to promote their wares. And if they are upset at you for what you did during the strike, mm-hmm. that may hurt your show long term.
Let's put this scenario forth. They email your assistant, Robert Axelrod.
Mm-hmm.
They say, we want Matt Bellany on the Drew Barrymore show. Do you go on?
Right now? Oh, interesting question. I am not in any of the guilds. I don't know. It would be tough for me to cross a picket line.
Right.
That's a good question. Again, I am not an advocate for either side. I have opinions on the issues mm-hmm. that are going on in the business. And I am a journalist, so I report on these things. But I also recognize that my role is not, I'm not promoting anybody's movie.
That's right.
I'm not promoting anything other than, I'm talking about the issues. And if they wanted to have me on, like, let's say Drew decided that she wanted to have a real interviewer come in and quiz her on why she did what she did and defend herself. I think that's interesting. I would not go easy on her. I would say in advance, like, if you want the real questions here, like, you know, what do you say to the thousands of other out of work people that would love to be able to call their boss and say, please, can we go back and, mm-hmm. and go back? I'd be curious what she would say.
I think that was a good audition for it. I hope it happens.
We'll see. I don't know that she wants that kind of inquisition.
I do not think so.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the state of play a little bit, because you were mentioning the tools that workers are using to fight back against the studios. Social media, increased pressure on those platforms, obviously a lot of newsletters and email campaigns and all that.
And picketing.
So I think a lot of Americans are familiar with the reasons why both the actors and writers are striking. But at this point, in the middle of September, can you walk us through what are basically the top line demands for each of these unions and where you feel they are at the negotiating table?
Well, there are what I call the normal issues, which are the typical union stuff. They want higher base wages. They want higher residuals. They believe that because of inflation and cost of living increases over the past few years, that those should be much higher than they have been traditionally in the past. These labor deals in Hollywood are negotiated every 3 years. So those are the basics, and they're apart on those, but I've always thought that those are bridgeable. Where they're kind of dug in are on three main topics. One is the AI issue, artificial intelligence, where the writers and actors have different demands on this front because they're different in how they perform their art.
Mm-hmm.
And the writers want guarantees that their work will not be used in language models to create AI scripts. And that is something where the studios have wanted a little bit more freedom to experiment. They've said essentially, this is all new. We don't know where this is going. And let's kick the can down the road 3 years and then we'll figure it out. And then mm-hmm. the writer's like, no. We're not falling for this. We're not going to be in a position of weakness in 3 years where you guys have already figured out what your AI strategy is. And then we're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. So that's one. The second one is on these writers' rooms, where it's a somewhat complicated issue, but because of the nature of streaming television and the fewer episodes per show that are often made on these streaming shows, it's no longer the day of 22 episodes in a full writer's room where writers will work for an entire year. The economics of being a writer on a show are much different now. So they want guarantees that there will be a certain number of writers that will be in these writers' rooms and protections against studios saying, okay, we're going to have one writer and then maybe he hires a couple of his friends on freelance basis, or maybe we hire one showrunner and then she will write the whole show and then we'll have other things. They want essentially guaranteed employment on certain shows. And the studios have been like, well, wait a second, we're not just going to hire people we don't need to hire just because of a union guarantee. This is not The Sopranos, where it's like the waste management company that has three guys sitting outside the Bada Bing when they are on the clock. They don't want that. The third issue is the transparency issue. This is the one that I am most sympathetic with. I've been going on and on about this for years. The studios hoard all the data mm-hmm. on who's watching what.
And why do they do that?
Well, wouldn't you do that if you could? I mean, I use the poker analogy. It's like playing with your cards to your vest and being able to see everybody else's cards.
Mm-hmm.
When you have all the data, you know the value of the asset. you know how valuable a show or movie is when you are seeing the consumption of that asset. And yes, the studios and streamers do share a little bit. Netflix puts out those top 10 lists. They do share some data with their showrunners, but it's not nearly enough. It's not tied to the compensation. And this is the, in my opinion, the existential issue. This industry is not going to be equitable until people can see all the cards.
Even in your latest newsletter, you said again explicitly that data transparency is an existential issue and one that the guilds are uniquely capable of fixing via a strike. Do you think they will?
I think they're making progress, and I actually do think that ultimately this deal will have a measure of data transparency. I mean, from my sources, Netflix, which has been the big holdout, has sort of said, we're okay with this. Now, the studio proposal that was in the rejected proposal was that they were okay providing data to the guild itself and not tying it to compensation. They said essentially, we'll give the guild the data, and then in 3 years, we'll figure out what a success metric might look like for residuals and other things. So that's, again, it's sort of a half solution, and the guild rejected that. So I think we are headed to some kind of a requirement to disclose data, which would be a great thing. And I say the guilds are uniquely situated to do this because the rest of Hollywood has had this opportunity for 15 years now. The agencies that represent the vast majority of talent, they could have said, no, we're not doing this deal unless you tell us what this show is worth to you and how many people are watching it and what all your internal metrics are. We represent the talent. If you want to work with this talent, you better tell us. The agencies didn't do that. The agencies said, okay, how much are you going to pay us? $300 million? Done. All money-based. So that is why the guilds are kind of the last resort here. They can shut down the industry. They can put a company like Netflix on the outs and say, you are not going to come in and be an interloper in this community unless you do the following things. The agencies and the other people in the equation, they fail to do that.
You're alluding to CAA, WME, UTA. You think they failed because why?
Because when Netflix came to town in the early 2010s, they knew exactly what they were doing. They wanted to disrupt 60 years, 70 years of a business model that worked for pretty much everyone. Not everyone, but pretty much everyone. And they said, no, we don't want to do it that way. We don't want to pay profit participation. We don't want to owe people money forever. At the time, they didn't even sell advertising. So they're like, well, we don't want to give away our data. The whole reason why Nielsen exists for television is because the advertisers wanted that data to determine how much they're going to pay. We don't have advertisers at Netflix, so we're just not going to do that. And there's a lot of things they did that they upended the industry on. And the way they got around it was money. They said, we're going to vastly overpay you. What's your quote? We'll give you 10, 20% more than your quote, but we're going to own the show forever. We're not going to give you any profit participation. The days of Seinfeld or Two and a Half Men or Big Bang Theory making hundreds of millions of dollars for their creators, that's over. We'll pay you a lot up front and there's no risk to you. But the home runs, we're going to keep all that value for ourselves. And there's a reason now people call this the Netflix strike, not against Netflix, the company, but this strike is against the model that Netflix brought to Hollywood.
So to help explain how we got here and really where we're at, your colleague over at Puck, Jonathan Handel, recently wrote that Netflix has seven key advantages over the competing studios inside the AMPTP. What are those for people who maybe don't know?
And this is from Jonathan Handel, who is a labor lawyer and has worked on both sides. He was worked for the WGA and he's also worked for the studio side. And he notes, I think, the big advantages. One, first mover. I mean, there is a big swath of streaming consumers who still equate streaming with Netflix. What's on streaming tonight? Boom, click, open Netflix. That is a huge first mover advantage. The second one is that the studios sort of gave them this advantage. The big mistake, I think, that most of the studio heads would tell you they made on streaming was not just that they didn't jump in soon enough, but they actively enabled the rise of Netflix by licensing Netflix their content. Netflix came along right at the time where the DVD market was going down. DVDs had propped up the industry for a decade or two, and streaming was becoming a thing. And the studios licensed their content to Netflix to get that big check. And all of a sudden, they created a monster.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is the direct-to-consumer relationship that Netflix built with its audience. Started with the DVD by mail mm-hmm. business, and then they successfully and kind of miraculously, they transformed that relationship into a streaming relationship. They had a lot of help with that, with the licensed catalogs from the studios, but also they started creating their own original shows. I mean, House of Cards was a huge gamble, and it paid off. That was a show that was shopped around town. HBO almost bought it. Netflix guaranteed 2 seasons up front, no pilot. And they said, oh, we'll do that. Guaranteed money up front. And it worked. That show was a huge hit. And I think the underestimated element of Netflix's advantage was the free money that they got. I mean, zero interest rates. That fueled so much of the streaming boom that we saw in the 2010s. When you're able to borrow money at no interest rate, you keep going and going and going, and they built scale. It's sort of like what Amazon did. They lost money for years until all of a sudden they had this business that everybody used and a direct-to-consumer relationship with all of their Prime customers that nobody could match. And then what do? They raise the prices mm-hmm. and they cut everybody else out. And Netflix now is the only streaming service that is profitable. All the other studio streaming services are losing money. Some are losing billions of dollars or have lost billions of dollars. They still are not to the level of scale that Netflix has, 235 million customers worldwide. And they're all playing catch up now. And mm-hmm. the market turned. The market turned. The market once wanted scale. Now it wants profitability in streaming. They want you to make money. And only Netflix is making money.
Your colleague at The Ringer, Andy Greenwald, who was formerly a critic, now writes for TV, is a showrunner, had this to say when asked about the state of streaming and how we got to this dire place you're talking about. This is Andy on a recent episode of The Watch. Let's take a listen.
From my layman's perspective,
uh-huh.
everybody's really fucking dumb. That's my perspective. Because from this violent lurching and chasing after the shiny thing has devalued everything across the board and left people in a moment, this exact moment, where you have conditioned more than one generation to expect to have everything everywhere all the time, all at once,
mm-hmm.
For relatively little money. And at this exact moment, when people do not have very much money, anecdotally, but also things are tough,
mm-hmm.
you are asking them to spend precipitously more. For who? For them. Because they mortgage their entire, not just their content libraries, the future of their business on a shareholder growth play that had no exit ramp, that had no chapter two, mm-hmm. that had no third act of Beetlejuice. There was no plan other than we will launch this and become popular and prove to everyone that we have something of value and we will lose billions in the process. That was where we got to where we are. And then, as you pointed out, interest rates changed. The state of play economically around the world changes. Ask the music industry. It is very, very, very hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube once people expect to get things for free.
As we were listening to that, you seemed like you were agreeing with all of it. And then it got to a moment around the conversation of an exit ramp that you kind of, I don't know, you seem skeptical.
Yeah, a little bit. And it's, Andy is right. I mean, the rush to streaming was a rush to replicate the Netflix model, which was priced artificially low mm-hmm. because of the free money coming into the system. When Disney launched Disney Plus, it was priced at $5 a month for the entire catalog of the Walt Disney Company, plus Marvel shows, plus Star Wars. I mean, it was artificially low because they wanted to build scale. Where I disagree a little bit with Andy is there was an off-ramp. Scale was the off-ramp. If you could get to 200, 300, 400, 500 million customers worldwide, which was the thinking at the time, you could build a scaled business that would be profitable. Now, what turned out to be the case, and perhaps this should have been more predictable for the companies, was that the level of scale was never going to be that high. There just weren't that many people around the world that were willing to pay for professionally produced content this way. And the level of competition, when all these other companies got into the mix, and all of a sudden you go from two or three streaming companies to seven or eight that are asking you to pay money, and you still have a cable subscription and money is tighter, that the squeeze was put on in a way that we didn't see coming. I think now the problem is that there is no off-ramp.
Mm-hmm.
He's right that right now, no one knows the answer, because they know that they have to be in streaming because linear TV is dying. They know that the race to just spend to create subscribers is not working because the market has turned and Wall Street will not value that. They want you to show profits. But if you start cutting and start selling your shows all over the place, then what's the value of your service, and where are you going to be down the line when we do have this consolidation? At some point, it's going to make sense for some company, whether it's Amazon, Apple, whether it's Disney, we don't know who it's going to be, to offer a bundle of multiple streaming services from multiple companies for one price, essentially trying to recreate the cable bundle, but in streaming. And that is where they are leaning, because there's never been a better business in the history of media than the cable bundle, because you get people to pay exorbitant prices for stuff they don't watch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the best business in the world. Pay and don't consume.
Are you at all deflated or depressed by the fact that this design really just feels like one big circle? We're going to come back to something that's equivalent to the cable box.
Yes, but we just got through discussing the fact that the last 15 years have been an overwhelming bargain for the consumer. They have been getting, as Andy noted, everything everywhere all at once for a price that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, my philosophy is I want to see a healthy economic ecosystem that supports creative talent and allows people to come into the entertainment business and make money. And if that means a bundle of services where, yeah, you used to gripe that you paid $10 for ESPN and you never watched it, maybe at some point you're going to pay $10 for ESPN Plus and never watch it. If that supports a healthy ecosystem, then I'm for that.
As Greenwald said in that clip, it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube once people expect to get something for free. But I'm curious about your perspective specifically, because as someone who came from The Hollywood Reporter, where you worked for 14 years through a period of transition as the business moved from print to digital, where The Hollywood Reporter, like many publications, began offering your product on the internet for free. How do you think about this conversation in 2023 as the cost of these products rise, despite generations, as Andy noted, who've grown accustomed to getting things for free?
It's an interesting question, because there are analogies to be made in what happened in publishing and what's happening in streaming. I mean, publishing has always been a dual business model where you pay your subscription, and it was artificially low because you were also monetized via advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And most publications, unless you're a very niche publication, the majority of money would be made through advertising. With the internet, it commoditized all that. And if you were putting your content on the internet for free, you had to generate an audience that would justify advertising on the internet, or you had to have a print product that was special enough to justify its existence on its own. And when I was at Hollywood Reporter, we did exactly that. We were a daily trade newspaper that transformed into a weekly glossy magazine in order to be appealing not just to readers, but to advertisers that wanted something that was differentiated from a newspaper or what they could get in digital. Now the model of Hollywood Reporter is scale and traffic on the internet. That is a somewhat challenged business. We've seen a lot of these big scale plays in digital publishing falter. Vice, BuzzFeed, where just having the scale and going for traffic and the empty calories of that, it's not as great of a business as people once thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, and this is one of the reasons why I was interested in being a founding partner at Puck, for certain audiences, quality matters, and they are willing to pay. And if you price it right and have differentiated content, and it's something that is not what you can read on Apple News or on the internet when you Google, that there is an audience there that will pay. It's very much like the old magazine model, where if you step into a publication like Puck, it's a world. It's a perspective. It's curated.
What about the world of entertainment journalism necessitated the world of Puck, the outlet you're with now?
I think it's just a difference in the goals. When you are selling advertising at a publication like Hollywood Reporter, you want the biggest possible audience. I mean, when I was there, the win for us was to take the access that we had to this community and the relationships and essentially turn it on its head and create content that would appeal to everyone. You know, you got the scoop on the new Star Wars movie. You weren't writing that story for the executives and talent around Hollywood. You were writing that story for Joe Blow in Iowa, who cares about Star Wars.
And Puck is for whom?
Puck is for people that want to go beyond the headlines. They're seeing the churn and the fire hose and all the other, you know, sources of information out there. And they want a curated, elevated, behind-the-scenes look at those industries that we cover. I'm for them.
After the break, more from Matt Bellany.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm curious because one of the things that distinguishes your work from others is clearly the access you have to people across the industry. But before you became a reporter, you were an attorney at AGS&K here in Los Angeles. How much of your editorial approach is informed by your time in and around law?
One, I think my demeanor and the way I approach the job, I necessarily have a bit of an adversarial touch to the way I operate.
Is that part and parcel of being a lawyer?
I think so. A litigator. I mean, there's deal lawyers who are the smoothest people in the room. That was not me. Mm-hmm. I was willing to question and challenge and argue if I had to. And I think that's sort of my style. Different journalists have different styles. That's always been I'm willing to defend. I'm willing to go to the bat for people. And that was always my brand. Secondly, I would argue there is no better education that you can have on the entertainment business than to be a litigation attorney working on entertainment cases.
Why is that?
Because I learned the business. I learned where the money was made. When I was a lawyer, we represented mostly talent in lawsuits against studios. So for instance, I represented Peter Jackson when he sued Warner Brothers over profits from Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. This was a franchise that had generated billions of dollars. And, you know, Peter Jackson was not getting paid what he thought he was owed. when you subpoena and you get to look at all of the documents from the studio, you see exactly how the money is made.
Mm.
They call it the waterfall, where money comes in. It's not the weekend box office. That's for public. It's when they license it overseas, when they package the film in a package of films that gets hundreds of millions of dollars to the studio, but the value is only in a certain number of those films in the package.
Mm-hmm. So you know where the bodies are buried.
Not specifically, but generally, yes. So
you have a sense of the gravesite.
Absolutely. And I know where to dig. And I know that, you know, I also, with that firm you mentioned, about a year and a half after I left, mm-hmm. that firm imploded. I had nothing to do with me.
They did release a statement. They said, once Bellany left...
It was all downhill from there.
To write freelance for Esquire and then moved to the Reporter.
Yes. They imploded. And what it did is it sent lawyers all over town. So I instantly had a base group of sources that did know where the bodies were buried and were willing to help me. And I found that the lawyers in my early days of my career were my best sources because I was sort of one of them. And they were willing to talk to me in maybe ways that they weren't willing to talk to your average trade reporter.
I want to talk about how you do the work you do, because when you're reporting on a story, what are the questions you're asking yourself before you put it into a newsletter or podcast? Because you've said in the past that your approach is obviously less formal than a New York Times or even a Hollywood Reporter. I guess I'm wondering, is it also less rigorous?
I adhere to typical journalistic processes, meaning I try to confirm it. If I can't confirm it, it's the question of who the source is, how much I trust them, their track record, whether I'm willing to go off of one source mm-hmm. on something.
How often are you willing to do that?
I mean, I wouldn't say a percentage, but there are people that know things and that are uniquely close to things that I will go off of one source.
Mm-hmm.
I usually try and confirm it, but and, you know, it's also about transparency with the audience. I mean, the nice thing about doing a newsletter format is the intimacy you have with the audience. It's not AP style. It's not the New York Times. You can say, one person told me this, haven't confirmed it, but here's what I've been told. Mm-hmm. And I would rather do that than not tell people what I've heard. I specifically named my newsletter What I'm Hearing for that reason. It is a dialogue with the readers. I wanted it to be like getting an email twice a week from your more informed friend. And that's why I write in a very conversational style. I tend to write how I talk at mm-hmm. lunches. And because of that format, it allows me to be transparent with the reader.
Do you think, as a former lawyer, you are especially attuned to people's bullshit?
Yeah, maybe. I think being around the entertainment business for 15, 20 years now, I think I am especially attuned to bullshit because of that, because I've been spun so many times.
What do you mean by spun?
Meaning, you know, you get someone calling you about one thing, but when the real story is something else, or they're downplaying, or, you know, you see it in the news all the time where someone announces a big, I'm, you know, moving to this company. And it's like, wait, what? You just got fired.
Where people are asking you to carry their water.
Yeah, there's so much hypocrisy and bullshit in the entertainment business that, you know, the media sometimes does a good job calling out, oftentimes does not. Most good journalists know a lot more than what they report for the various rules of their publication or because of their sourcing relationships. I have the ability in the format and the outlet to say more of what I know.
That was my last question on this, which is, how often are you given information by someone who then moments later says to you, that's for you, not the newsletter?
Oh, all the time. All the time. And I honor those relationships. Or someone will say, you know, this is happening on Monday. I want you to know in advance, but you can't report it.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, just like anything else. I want people to feel comfortable having that dialogue with me and not feeling like I'm going to turn around and you know, air their wares on my newsletter.
And those that have tried, even in 2023, mm-hmm. to spin you in some way, to treat the newsletter like some vessel, how do you navigate those relationships after that? Are they irreparable?
I don't know. I there's only a few publicists that I won't talk to and some that I've kind of made villains of my column. But I don't know. I mean, I will call someone. If I feel like someone has spun me, I'll call and have that conversation after the item runs. Someone might email me and say, like, dude, you missed the real story here, or this is what's really going on. And then I'll circle back and I'll be like, okay, so am I only presenting one side of this.
Mm.
I try to get as close as I can, and I try to be as transparent as possible and let the readers decide.
To bring us back to where we started, in the beginning, when you parlayed some of that lawyerly acumen into a career in journalism, you do some pieces for Esquire, you then move to the Hollywood Reporter, and one of the earliest pieces you publish is called A Steady Hand Guided This Strike Settlement. You name a lawyer named Alan Wertheimer, who you write was a steady hand that helped negotiations get past personal squabbles to reach a resolution during the last writer's strike. That was in 2007, 2008. Bringing us back to this current strike, is there someone like Alan that you predict will emerge as a steady hand that these negotiations clearly so badly need?
It's a great question, and I know that there is a lot of back channeling going on. Lawyers like Alan and lawyers around town, and you know, the agents not so much, because the writers are very suspicious of their agents and vice versa.
And I've heard agents have done some of that.
They have, but the agents have asked to get involved in the negotiations, and the writers have essentially said, no, we're good. So I don't think it's going to be one of the agents that does this. Maybe one of the big lawyers around town, but it gets to the bigger problem in the industry right now, which is that there is no statesperson. I think that if there was someone, we probably would have seen that person come about. And once the strike is resolved, there's going to be a lot of people that take credit for having resolved the strike. Some of it will probably be true. I know, you know, Ted Sarandos would love to be the hero that comes in and solves this.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of these studio heads, they see how this is playing out and how they've been villainized by the guilds, and they don't love that. So I wish I had an answer for you. I don't know who the White Knight is going to be.
Well, I'm going to ask you a series of questions in the style that you would ask them on The Town, with the same preface that you offer all your guests, which is, I know you don't want to make predictions, but I'm going to have to make you do it anyway. So when is this going to end?
All right. So that is the number one question I get asked everywhere I go around town. My prediction right now is mid-October. I still think that as the, you know, there's all this stuff about how October 1 is the drop dead if they want to resume production this year. I think that's probably pushable a little bit. I initially predicted that I thought it would last until mid-September. I had been saying that since May. And the breakdown the last time around in late August caused me to push that.
Mm.
But I do think the urgency after Labor Day has really ratcheted up, and we're going to see some movement. If not this next week with this new WGA meeting with the studios, then soon after that with some of the actors perhaps. So I don't know. I just don't, any longer than that, and the damage into next summer is going to be so catastrophic that the studios will, I think, give. And ultimately, I think more so than in the last strike, the writers are going to gain more in this one. I see the way it's going and their willingness to hold out and the studios' recognition that they're going to have to give on some of these transparency and AI issues. I think that that's going to give the guild something to really crow about.
I want to hit all three sides before we go. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the writers. The conversations I've been having with members in the guild all speak to kind of what you're talking about. There is what they told me was a victory or vanquish mentality. As we near day 140 of the strike, so much has been lost. So much pain has been endured that to get to the end of these negotiations without a deal that doesn't even kind of resemble what they're asking for is just not going to happen.
That's a good point. And I think that the guild has dug in so much on these issues, and they've made promises to all the various constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all in this together. We're not going to leave anyone behind. I mean, they've already said to the studios, don't come back to us unless you address every single one of our points. And the studios, in their most recent proposal, at least on their side, they said that they did. Now, they weren't to satisfaction of the guild, but they at least addressed each one. And that's on the writer's terms. They said that because the initial studio proposal did not even go there on some of them. So the fact that they're negotiating on the terms that the guilds want, I think is a good sign for the guild. But the promises they made are going to require them to deliver because so much has been lost.
Where do you think they'll gain ground, and where do you think they may not get exactly what they want.
So I think the transparency stuff, they are going to gain significant ground. Whether they get a success-based residual this time around, I don't know. The actors are asking for 2% of revenue mm-hmm. from each show and movie. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they will compromise, but they will get something based on success metrics and data. Where I don't think the writers will get what they want is on the staffing issue. I have heard that the union itself is not aligned on that. A lot of the showrunners don't want that or don't prioritize it. They're like, really? We're striking over this, like an extra couple writers in a room that I didn't even ask for? But I think there's an even bigger compromise to be made. Maybe the showrunner hires the number of writers that he or she wants, and then if there's a discrepancy between what the guild wants and that number, maybe there's a contribution made to a fund that helps train young writers.
Right.
Or something where the studios don't feel like they're paying for the guys to stand outside the bada bing, and the writers can feel like there's a path where training is happening and people will get that path mm-hmm. to become showrunners themselves one day.
I don't know where David Chase stands on all this.
I don't either. He's hasn't been, a lot of the big showrunners have been silent during this whole fight, which I think is a little telling. You haven't heard much from the, you know, David Kellys and Shonda Rhimes, and, you know, they're supportive of their guild, but they
haven't.
But this
isn't really about them.
It's not about them, but they carry an enormous weight within the industry. And if they were out there every day, maybe that would make a difference. They haven't been. I'm not casting judgment at all on those people, but there is a sense from some that maybe, you know, they aren't as gung-ho about some of these issues as some of the rank and file people are.
Do you think that's in part because they're living in completely different universes?
Yeah, I mean, this is the weird thing about the Writers Guild. I mean, these people, these big showrunners, they're managers. Mm-hmm. They're bosses. They hire and fire. They get budgets that mm-hmm. they have to spend. And that's what's so weird about this guild is that it's not like the United Auto Workers. The majority of the members of the Writers Guild don't work or are not working or not working enough to get health insurance. And then you have this extraordinary wealth among certain members. It's necessarily conflicted because people are at different places.
The last thing I want to say for the writers, I'm sure you've seen the email they've sent out to members, the numbers they've put to the media about the annual costs, revenue for these companies, and what they are asking for, a percentage based on those revenues. Just a couple that we've talked about. The Netflix annual revenue is $31.6 billion. The ask that is being made from the WGA is 0.206%. For Warner Brothers Discovery, it's 0.104. Paramount Global, 0.143. In case you're wondering, it never gets anywhere close to 1%. You're shaking your head while I'm reading these numbers. What is right about that argument and what is wrong about it?
Well, first of all, if I was the WGA, I would be doing exactly what they're doing and putting out these numbers. I would also be focusing on the salaries of these top studio executives, mm-hmm. which are enormous and ridiculous. It's a little misleading. They cherry pick some of the numbers, and it's hard to determine what these asks will ultimately cost. I mean, what is the cost of greater transparency in data? What is the cost of forfeiting on the AI issue? Some of these things are kind of unknowable. So when they're asking for an 11% increase in basic wages, which is what the actors have asked for, yeah, that's quantifiable. They can say, okay, that translates into X, and we can parse that out. But on some of these other more existential, bigger picture issues, it's hard to make that calculation.
You know, it's not just the writers that have focused on the salaries of CEOs. The actors have also focused on this. Here is Fran Drescher on NPR just last week, making her position on the strike very, very clear.
Let me just say this. When a CEO is making $78,000 a day, when a studio makes $1 billion on a weekend, please do not plead poverty to me. Just make a good deal. You could be the hero in the story. Just pivot. Start being inclusive. Start realizing that we're not peons. We're not serfs. We're in this together. Honor our artistry. exalt what we bring to the world. Share the wealth, and you'll see that, you know, the business will have much more longevity and much less of this kind of thing.
Thoughts?
Listen, Fran is a very effective communicator, and her press conference in the first couple days of the actors' strike was extremely effective in communicating to the general public that this was not billionaires squabbling with millionaires, mm-hmm. that there was a rank and file fight for the continued existence of acting as a middle class job. So more power to Fran for having done that. Having said that, what she's saying is put in very simplistic terms. And the fact of the matter is that while these studio executive salaries are outrageous and media executives have been overpaid for decades, that is not new. Streaming is a very difficult business, and all of these companies are losing money in streaming. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're making $1 billion in a weekend. I don't know where that came from. Maybe a film crossed the $1 billion mark that weekend. That's what she's talking about. Yeah, the Barbie movie is making $1.5 million. Warner Brothers has had a string of flops this year. So I don't want to say that entertainment isn't a good business. The history of the entertainment business has been a history of growth. Mm. And they have always figured it out and figured out where the next revenue stream is going to come from. And we are in a dark point right now, just like the music business was before it came upon this streaming model. And year after year, they've ratcheted it up. And music is not where it was in the late 90s, early 2000s, but it's growing. And I think Hollywood will follow a similar trajectory once streaming is figured out. But right now, the business is challenged. And I think objectively, that's a contributing factor in why we are where we are.
You know, if we were to continue playing that clip from the interview she did just last week, you would have heard her say, quote, "This insatiable appetite for money, that they are still not seeing that the culture needs to change, that they need to change," they being the studio. "This conversation is bigger than our contract. It's about caring. It's about being empathetic."
Welcome to Hollywood, Fran. It's not a caring or empathetic place.
Well, that's sort of my point. When you hear the argument being presented in those terms,
yeah,
and then you hear, you know, an executive going to Deadline saying, "We are waiting for the writers to go homeless. We are waiting for folks to lose their apartments, their homes, any amount of savings they may have built up over the last year and a half." There's about like a gulf in three oceans between those two presentations.
Yeah, and I don't think that the caring argument is the argument to make. The argument to make is that this is a smart business decision to make a deal with these writers and actors.
So why is she leaning into empathy in regards to capitalism?
You'd have to ask her, but I think that the messaging maybe that interview was designed to reach a larger audience to gain public support for the writers and actors.
Which they already have.
Which they have, but they have in part because of the messaging mm-hmm. from people like her. She's a very famous person and she can get press attention like some of the others cannot get.
But union sentiment across the country is somewhere between 65 and 75% for the last year and a half.
And it's been rising.
That's
because
right.
of some of the income disparity that we've seen over the past two decades. And it's not a coincidence that the income disparity is tracking with support for unions. Mm-hmm. But I think the smarter argument to make and the more resonant argument is entertainment as a business does not work unless we have a viable career path for writers and actors. It can't just be a gig economy. I know necessarily it is a gig economy, but it can't just be that only 5% of the guild can make a living at this. We need to raise wages overall so that this is a bigger, better, and stronger business. That's the argument that will resonate. Or the argument is, you know what? You guys are going to be dispassionate about this and make the hard cuts when you need to make the hard cuts.
Mm-hmm.
We're dispassionate too. We're going to shut this place down until we get the deal that we want. And if you guys don't want to make that deal, we'll sit here as long as we want.
Well, in order for a deal to get made, the last part of this triumvirate, so to speak, is the AMPTP. And there have been several reports. I don't know if it's wishful thinking or it's people leaking certain information that the way this deal is going to happen is that the guilds are going to negotiate with one of the studios, like a Paramount or Warner Discovery, that has less to do with Netflix and Amazon, at least in terms of how they both make money. Do you believe that's going to happen?
I don't, and for a number of reasons. I mean, it is true that the eight key members of the AMPTP are sort of in two factions. There's the traditional studios that have a traditional model where they may have other businesses, but the primary model is making and selling film and television.
That's Paramount.
Paramount, Sony, Warner Brothers, Disney, and Universal. Then there are these other three companies, Apple, Amazon, and Netflix. Netflix is sort of weird in there, but Apple and Amazon in particular, their primary business is not making Hollywood content. In fact, it's sort of a luxury slash loss leader slash value halo business that they're in. And the thinking is that if they're okay with just letting this go on, then you could peel off certain other companies and do deals with them. The AMPTP, these companies have signed a contract to negotiate together. They have joined a coalition. It's a cartel, really. They're not allowed to collude in any aspect of their business except for the purpose of labor negotiations.
Well, it seems like we're getting back to the bada bing.
Right. So they are in a cartel that is a legal cartel, but they sign a contract and there are provisions that would govern if anybody wanted to leave.
Normal people are listening to this and they're like, what the hell is a legal cartel?
Well, it is. I mean, there are, I don't know the answer to that, but... But it is a, when I say that, it is a government-endorsed
coalition. No, I know what you mean.
Coalition.
It's just hilarious that that is an actual term.
It is.
That people are like, oh, no, this is the good cartel. Right. This is the legal cartel.
Sure. I mean, I guess like the oil, you know, the yeah. Saudis, and they're all in a legal cartel.
Look where we are now.
Yes. So my point is that it's not as easy as just saying, oh, we'll pick them off one by one. I would be surprised if that happened.
So all eight of these companies have to agree unanimously to go back to the table and agree to those certain conditions, whatever they are.
Yes.
Paramount makes movies. Amazon sells toilet paper.
Yeah.
Apple sells iPhones. The only thing they have in common is capitalism, although honestly, the way they each make money is so, so different.
Yeah.
Just this morning in your old publication, Hollywood Reporter, Kate Kilkenny reported that one high-level management side source with knowledge of the current state of play says companies have to push Carol, who's the lead negotiator, Carol Lombardi, out of her comfort zone. Carol works from an old-fashioned playbook, and she thinks taking 3 weeks to respond to the guilds is okay. She's never dealt with tech companies.
I don't know.
How do we solve that?
I mean, I think Carol is a very sophisticated negotiator. And if she's delaying for a reason. I think if there's any misread, it's that she is not recognizing the anger and the solidarity amongst the unions and the social media that is added pressure, and that she is underestimating the leverage on the side of the union. I do think that's true.
You know, as we leave, I'm just thinking back to when you really got started in this industry, the 2007, 2008 writer's strike. How different are the conversations you're having now? Like, have you seen the attitudes change? And what does that sound like?
I think it's significantly changed. Back in 2007 and 2008, Hollywood was still a very old school, traditional business that had operated a certain way. It was very clubby. Was insulated. And yes, there were these labor skirmishes that would pop up, but the expectation is that they would be resolved. And it was about money. The influx of the tech companies into entertainment over the past 15 years has totally upended that. The people are different. It's not the old school clubby nature of Hollywood anymore. This is a business that has been pretty significantly disrupted. And thus the conversations and the fights that people are having are more significant. It's not just about money. And that is, I think, it's made it chaotic. It's caused anxiety across the board. People don't know where this business is going to go, if it's even going to be a viable business at all.
Do you think it will be?
I do think it will be. I think it's going to go through a really rocky transition.
Have we started that?
We have started that. We have definitely started that. But it's only the beginning. And the next 5 to 7 years are going to be a lot of pain and a lot of realignment. And ultimately, I think the business will come out of it because I think there is always going to be a desire for professionally produced content that is meaningful to people. And it's not like this hasn't happened before. You know, movies begat television, begat home video, begat DVDs. All of that was initially considered the death knell of the traditional industry, and people figured out how to make money on it. And streaming will be the same.
You know, my last question for you, you're describing this moment of upheaval, of transition, where we're in the midst of going through some growing pains. And in that, I'm thinking about so many of the advancements made in the last 15 years, you know, whether it's AI, print publications going to digital, the rise of social media. And then I'm thinking about some of the people responsible for those innovations and how some of them, not all of them, but some of them in the last, say, 3 to 5 years have come forth and expressed pretty real guilt and regret. You know, the godfathers of artificial intelligence that have come forth and expressed fear about where this technology they created is headed. I'm thinking about editors at certain big newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc., most of whom have come forth and said, you know, it took too long to go from print to digital. And because of how slow we moved, we have irreparably damaged the news industry, especially local newspapers across the country. I'm thinking about Jack Dorsey and Twitter, who has expressed regret about the rampant misinformation spread on his platform. And so now, as we leave, thinking about the studios and the technological rabbit hole that they fell down trying to chase Netflix, trying to chase a tech company that had all the advantages you outlined earlier. The decade-long head start, the licensing deals that these studios made with Netflix for a quick payday, the technology that Netflix had that they had to recreate on their own. And I'm thinking about those institutions, part of the AMPTP, and those involved in this strike. In those conversations you've had with people on the studio side, have you heard anything resembling regret about these last 15 years? Any guilt about some of the missteps made that have, in part, delivered us, brought us to this moment, to this crisis, to this inflection point? And I guess I'm wondering if they feel it is at all odd that they are now asking artists across the industry to carry some of the burden, to fix some of the problem that those artists did not create.
I think that that's a good question. And the answer isn't easy. Do I think that Netflix regrets disrupting the model? No. Absolutely not. They were very explicit about it. And I even think I disagree a little bit with some of your premise where, yeah, there have been people at Google and AI companies that have expressed regret. Doesn't stop them from riding the private jets around the world or buying the Malibu mansions. They are very happy. Mark Zuckerberg.
Absolutely.
Mark Zuckerberg killed a lot of news organizations with his pivot to video and then pivot away. He's not regretting that at all. He is creating a business and he has his worldview and they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that they
are. Some people have more guilt than others.
Yes.
No question.
And I don't think that Netflix has any regret. I think on the studio side, on the traditional studio side, mm-hmm. there is some regret that they followed Netflix off the cliff. And these companies that are now run by different people mm-hmm. than the ones who made those decisions, like Warner Brothers Discovery, they have been critical of the previous strategy and the all-in on streaming and the decisions that were made that have led us to this point. That doesn't make it any easier on the artist who is essentially being asked to atone for the sins of his employer. And that hurts. The only thing I will say is that a lot of people benefited from the streaming wars and the peak TV era. There were a lot of shows that would never have been made, 600 scripted shows last year, a lot of shows that would have never been made even 10, 12 years ago that were made. So these artists got to make the show and the movie they wanted to make. And when we see that contraction that is coming, you're going to see a number of those shows that probably would have been made not being made. So people did benefit. They got paid. They got to do their art. And Now it's just a matter of how bad it's going to hurt and where we come out on the other side.
Contraction, growing pains, the ride has just started.
Yeah.
Give us the one positive part, the one positive result that you could see coming from these deals in the next month, in the next few months.
In the next few months, I was going to say, generally speaking, periods of chaos and anxiety and questions tend to produce new things. And whatever emerges from this will possibly be new, exciting, and reinvent the model. If audiences are no longer willing to support $200 million comic book movies in theaters, maybe there'll be a new genre of movie that takes over and it doesn't become as stale as it has been.
You know, I really hope you're right. And until that moment, I want to just thank you for trying to make sense of a situation that I think to many people has not made a whole lot of sense.
Thank you.
Matt Bellany, take care. And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple, wherever you do your listening. If you want to go above and beyond, leaving us a review on Apple really does help new listeners find the show. I want to give a special thanks this week to Robert Axelrod and, of course, our guest, Matt Bellany. You can find his podcast, The Town, wherever you are listening to this right now. We'll also include a link to his twice weekly newsletter at Puck in our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more conversations, I'd recommend our episodes with Tom Hanks, Kara Swisher, Alex O'Keefe, Natasha Lyonne, Sam Sanders, and Judd Apatow. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Our research and production assistant is Paulina Suarez. Today's talk was edited by CJ Mitchell and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our assistant editors are Clarice Guevara and Lindsay Ellis. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizak, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. Special thanks, as always, to the team at Pushkin Industries. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Isabella Narvaez, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Maya Koenig, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Lital Malad, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next week with another episode. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.